connecting like antennae, hands curling together into their familiar embrace. "Are we in a video game?" I ask. "Did I fall asleep?" "No," she says. "You aren't in a video game. Come back." In the distance, I see the silhouettes of the campus buildings, but they look strange, two-dimensional. "Okay," I say. We walk, our footsteps echoing flatly against the pavement. There is no detail to the cement anymore. No dark patches of long-chewed gum or pale scratches from skateboards. It's just gray, like everything. "I feel like I've known you a long time, Sarah," I say. "I know," she says, and we walk on. "That's so odd," she says after a few moments. "What?" "The only thing left out here is the way I walk to campus," she says. "Everything else is just gray." An apocalypse should be loud. Gunshots and rioting, that kind of thing. Life screaming out to live. But this is quiet. Dark. The gray of forgotten details. The people are just gone. People I never knew, never will know. Standing at the dorm window, I watch as the round eye of the sun suddenly spreads out and leaks into light that comes from all directions. The cardboard city outside goes dull, even flatter somehow. And after that, the dark doesn't come again. Sarah lies on her bed, asleep. She is so clear to me. Her colors are vibrant. The radius of reality is shrinking. But Sarah is this one constant thing. The curve of her cheek on the pillow is so familiar. How strange that I am 20. How strange that I have known her for so long in such a short amount of life. I think we are the last ones living in Sarah's dormitory. Sometimes I wander through the empty hallways, peek into the rooms. Before, each room was different, but now they're all the same. A twin bed across from a sink, a whining fluorescent light, always on, flickering. Wooden drawers built into the wall, and a gray square of glass. "I don't know if the campus is really there anymore," I say to Sarah, and panic is building in my throat. "It's just this room. It's just us." Her hand closes onto mine. My thoughts are lazy ripples through still water. The realization comes slow, like mist evaporating off a pond. Sarah is the dreamer. We lost the stars on the day she hit her head. The more she sleeps, the more we lose. The gray of her forgetting is eating the world. Now only her strongest memories are alive. The walk to class. This room. Me. I move closer to her sleeping body, press myself against her. This morning. Morning. Is there such a thing anymore? I walk to the front door of the dormitory and I look out, and I see that the sky is missing. A post box is on its side in the street, half buried in the pavement. The red metal skin of it is juddering on and off. Between the blinks, I can see mail inside. Before I go back upstairs, I put my hand on the glass of the door, and it doesn't feel cool. It doesn't feel warm, either. It doesn't feel like anything. Sarah is curled on her bed, shaking. She is shaking and moaning. I hold her, feel her hair slithering over my arms. The world outside is getting smaller. Sarah shakes. The forgetting grows. I don't remember waking up. I am floating in gray. My body is falling through the walls, and it's so familiar. I am holding Sarah in my arms, and I can feel the cool sand of the beach under my hip. I am stroking her sea-smelling hair and murmuring into the soft dampness. It will be okay, I'm saying. You're the dreamer, Sarah. We can find each other in your dreams, I say to her. And then the smell of her hair is gone, along with the feel of the sand. I open my eyes to look down at my body, and I am tumbling, spinning in space because I have no eyes. There is no body. All of it has finally gone away. Things unseen are not rendered. And yet I am still here. I am thinking. My thoughts are somewhere, churning in the gray. Sarah slipped through my fingers. Was she my dream, then? Am I the dreamer? Even now, there is this one constant thing. A pressure where my hand should be. Fingers laced into mine, squeezing. I can remember if I try very hard. Final stage. I hear the whisper. Something beats at my eyes. A flutter of reality. A line of hard light appears and shatters my vision into a briar's patch of eyelashes. I am opening my eyes. And I find myself lying in a flower-smelling bed under a clean white ceiling that is chopped into neat squares. There is a gray video screen hanging on the wall. Final stage, says that unfamiliar voice. Neural calibration and transmission complete. Sarah? Eyes swiveling down, I see that my right hand is a leathery claw, laced with blue-black veins, knuckles twisted and humped. A small moan comes from my dry, cracked throat. I am old. I am ancient. I am 20. How am I 20? And my Sarah? She is lying next to me on the bed. It's a hospital bed. This isn't right. Where is our dorm? Her lips are peeled back into a sweet, worried smile. And I can see a hint of that beauty I remember in her youthful, angular face. A dimple still lodged stubbornly in her sagging cheek. We are old. Melted like wax. I was saving my wax. I blew out my candle. I was 20. Years have draped themselves over us. Did we fall asleep? I lost you, I say. No, she whispers. We're together now. Forever. The screen on the wall flickers, shows me something painful. Sarah and I are standing together on the screen. Versions of us, in the computer. We are holding hands and smiling. It makes me cry to see us so young. Neural upload complete, says the voice in the gray. Both computational entities are viable. It's a success, people. I think the world is running away between my blinks. The screen and the ceiling and the walls are splitting off and falling into the great forgetting. Only she is vibrant. Hosts are losing mental cohesion, says a gray whisper. Sarah. She is lying next to me on her back with tears tracing down her temple. Our fingers have found their old familiar places. Her face is so bright that it hurts my eyes. Her lips are red again. Her hair is a sun-kissed brown. We are both trying so hard to hold on. Sarah? I ask. I'm not scared anymore, she says, and her teeth are so white. It'll be okay. We'll find each other in our dreams. Her hand in mine. It's all that matters. In all of this forgetting, there is this one constant thing. Her name is Sarah. I will always remember that.
Garden of Life. The Garden of Life is complex, way beyond the ken of humankind. Textbooks say science has only stumbled upon around 10% of all existing species of plants and animals. There could be from 10 to 100 million more. Critters, big and small, mostly small, are living and reproducing and dying, as they have for eternity, without a human being ever so much as laying eyes on them. It's a wide old world out there for a taxonomist. There are more living things hidden in the wilds than we'll ever know. Life likes to break free and spread, and what you can find will surprise you. I'm on what I call one of my long jaunts. A jaunt is supposed to be short by definition, but I enjoy the paradox. In fact, I enjoy it just about every weekend and holiday. Come Saturday morning, I pull on my hiking boots, tuck my pant legs into them, and lace them up tight. Out here in the mountains, there's a particular area that's all mine to explore. Miles of government land surrounding some kind of research center. Scrubby deer trails meandering through scalp-prickling heat. Tick-infested pine trees and plenty of poison ivy. But every now and then, you'll find a cool hollow. Caves gouged out of sweating granite. Plenty of microclimates are hiding there in the rough country, off the horse trails and way aways from where idiot four-wheelers scream and churn mud. Worse it is out here, the better I like it. Some people get a thrill jumping from a plane. Out on the lake, kids will get those wakeboards going faster than I'm comfortable driving my Chevy half-ton on the highway. That's not for me. I get my jollies in the wild, hunting for brand new insect species. I send my specimens to an old buddy at the university's entomology department. I then play the waiting game. Sometimes I hit pay dirt. And then comes the best part. I get to name them. Gryllus Oklahomas was my last find. A field cricket under a piece of rotten bark. Named that little dude in honor of my state, and kept on looking for more. I find the fist-sized knot in the base of a dead pine tree, sort of a cubby hole in the shape of a stop sign. The little hexagon has too many straight lines to be from nature, so I stoop down on creaking knees and take a look. The smell of burning wood wafts from the hole. Peering into the thing, I see that it holds what looks like a plastic cube with an ember in it, and around the lip of the hexagonal hole, I see a brownish leg that is moving in precise jerks. It has a claw tip, and it's busy scratching, building something. Staring at it for a second, I realize it's making another little arm, a perfect copy of itself. What in the... I ask the empty woods. When I was a kid, I used to find fairy nests near the creek that ran behind my parents' place. Little shacks made of sticks and moss and leaves placed around a shade tree or in a sun-dappled clearing. In those days, kids roamed free, and I spent a whole summer hunting those fairy nests with a kind of magic in my heart. One night at dinner, I finally told my mama about what I'd found. I will always remember the little smile she gave me. All of a sudden, I knew exactly where those fairy houses came from. I knew, but I never stopped searching. Something tickles my hand, and I give a yelp. In the dirt, I see a handful of marbles. Only they're moving on lots of legs, like pillbugs or roly-polies, as we once called them. The insects are trundling and falling over a piece of bark, peeling splinters from the wood. The size of thimbles, each one has a raspy spot on its belly. They drag themselves over the wood and shred little pieces off. I watch one pick up a splinter with tiny mandibles and climb right into the hexagonal hole. He's tending the fire in there, keeping energy going to his factory. This is a whole new deal. I climb onto my knees and rifle through my field bag, pick up one of the little crawlers with tweezers, and drop it into a glass specimen jar. I screw the lid on tight and wonder if it really needs air holes. Can't say whether this little dude breathes or not. For the life of me, it looks like the bug is made of some kind of metal. Government land, you know. Hard to say what the scientists are doing in those fenced-off buildings. Only thing I know is that life likes to break free. Life likes to spread. Getting to my feet, I shade my eyes and look deeper into the woods. Now, I notice a lot of the trees are dead, more than usual. And it may just be my old eyes, but I feel like there's a haze over everything. A thin smear of smoke from more of those miniature power plants. More smoldering factories out there in the sun-baked woods. I stand still, and the movement of the crawlers seeps into view. Thousands of them, the color of dirt and leaves, dragging themselves like a living carpet over the ground. The hair goes up on the backs of my arms. Somewhere out there, far off, I hear a tree splinter and crack. A shadow sweeps, and I hear a hollow thump. The captured crawler clinks against its jar, and I flinch a little bit. Time to get back to the truck. I shrug my pack on tighter and turn around. And even though I start out walking at a reasonable pace, before long I'm running. In the truck, I don't take it easy on the accelerator. I'm on a dirt road for a few miles, meandering alongside razor wire fences. My tires chew the rocks loudly, and I can't see anything but my dust trail in the rear view, which is fine with me. When I finally stop at the sign to get onto paved road, it gets quiet, except for my ragged breathing. I'm gripping the steering wheel, knuckles like mountain ridges. Then I hear the scratching sound from next to me. Fingers shaking. I swipe all the trash off the passenger seat. A curled yellow newspaper, a pair of work gloves, and an Auto Trader magazine waterfall onto the floorboard. Underneath, I find more of my friends with no names. Guess I must have left my window open while I was exploring the woods. The crawlers are busy making themselves right at home, pulling strips of fabric out of the seat back. They're carving out a neat hexagon shape. I take a deep breath and put my foot on the gas. A shaky smile has got onto my face. The Garden of Life, see? She's way beyond the ken of humankind. The textbooks say we've barely scratched the surface. At the first exit, I head off toward the university. I'm pretty sure these bugs are made of metal, and I'm pretty sure they were built and not born. But if nature doesn't care, then neither do I. I'm already thinking of names.
All kinds of proof. Joe is a misanthrope and a drunk. I never did take to cigarettes, you know, or any of the ones after them. Vaping, e-cigs, charged burners. There's always an electronic version of everything these days. A sparkling paint job plastered over the same old shit. The suits have got to move merchandise somehow, I guess. But I never took to any of it. What happens with me is whenever somebody tries to convince me of something, my gut reaction is a big old
Fuck you, buddy. Head down and I'm moving on, you understand? Keep the change. If there's some kind of an organization to whatever it is, then just forget about it. And that goes for everything. Religion, sports, the job. Hell, especially the job side of things. You learn a little about yourself after 5 or 6 decades. And I know I'm mostly built to be solitary, in that I can handle about 1 other human being. 2 at most, and then only when I was young. And despite every goddamn Hollywood movie, I don't think a person can help the way they're built. You can't change what's in your heart or grow a pair of balls all of a sudden. For Christ's sake, just be honest with yourself and get on with living your life. Maybe try and do the best you can for the ones you do care about. I tend to think about this kind of garbage while I'm sitting outside the Goose, not smoking cigarettes, staring down my first whiskey and beer back of the day. Something to get my eyes open in the early afternoon is all. And if you're judging me, you should see the other regulars. My spot is on the front sidewalk of the Goose Hill Bar and Grill, alone at a rickety table next to a dented dog bowl that the bartender, Mallory, sometimes remembers to fill with water. I'm about 1 foot from the curb, and usually on the verge of getting my neck snapped by a side-view mirror. Through an open window, I can see the barflies who sit inside. At the moment, Sherry, the back of her neck tattooed with spider webs, is lighting up the place with her cackle. Adrian, an aging busker in a purple beret, is hee-hawing right along with her. She really is the queen of the bar, holding court to that fawning group of well-lubricated drunks. Mallory pours them strong, God bless her, and that's why we're all here. I can smell the stale cigarette smoke wafting around the corner of the building. The bums who sit over there in the smoking section, I can't see them, can only hear their occasional shouting matches, are coughing down butts plucked from the sidewalk after a long day scrounging and begging. They're literally bums over there, you know? It's not just a turn of phrase or petty name-calling on my part. Good for the bums, though. Any one of us could end up around that corner quicker than we might suspect. At least they're enjoying themselves. Up the other way are a bunch of metal pigs. They've got a name that I forget, but the 3 sculptures are fat and silver and bolted to the sidewalk, just the right size for kids to climb around on until they fall off and get hurt, which they nearly always do. The pigs are wearing chains around their necks with their names on them, and at their feet is a homemade lockbox, welded together out of solid steel, with a rolling tube for dropping money inside. A shitty piece of half-laminated, half-soaked paper is taped to it. Donations. It seems like such an obvious scam, I can't believe how many people jam coins and bills inside the thing, you know? Every few days, the dude we call Hemingway comes shuffling out of the Goose with a few leaves of curled-up newspaper in his gnarled fingers. He wears a navy blue flat cap and a beard as white as sea spray. He must be in his late 70s, but the old reprobate still has twinkling blue eyes and the swagger of a 20-year-old. Hemingway. It takes him a few minutes, but he'll toss down his papers, crouch to unlock the box, and then dump and scrape the money out onto the newspaper. He rolls it up, takes it inside, and my guess is he gives it straight to Mallory to pay his tab. It happens quiet and on a regular schedule, and nobody says a thing about it. Those shining pigs are dumb and mute, and they're a lifeline for the old bastard. I see it all from my perch. The folks here mostly give me space to myself, and that's fine. I'm not clubby. In case you hadn't guessed, my preference is to observe. So, yeah, That means I enjoy watching the angular girls in clunky glasses that come clip-clopping past, the kind with soft eyes and sharp hips, who send a snap of endorphins thrashing through a man's brain at the speed of a grunt. But that's not what I mean by observe. What I'm trying to talk about is all those things we see, and yet we don't see. Like the kid wearing a sagging backpack and his straight-laced customer walking side by side, making their exchange in a subtle clasp of hands. Or the elderly guy reaching into an open car window and snatching a jacket off the seat. Or maybe it's something more altruistic, like a shopkeep dropping a pair of old boots next to some sorry lump in a sleeping bag. It's those little times, those fleeting moments when people don't expect a reward or a punishment. I enjoy bearing witness to them. Because things are happening, you know? And what I really mean to say by that is, things are going down. And more clearly, shit is going down. All around us, all the time, on any street. Even on these wet Portland streets. So, that's my thing. I sit in the flow for a couple days or months, years or decades, watch the shadows creep over the pavement, and the shoes traipse back and forth. And after a while, I'm grown into a place like a tree through a chain-link fence. The world is pretty goddamn interesting, if you look at it long enough. Have a little patience and imagination. You wait for something to happen. And if it doesn't, why then you wait some more. My problem with it is, a guy can only go it alone for so long. I don't need much, but I'm sure as hell no island. I get lonely, like anybody. And in life, I think most of us need a confidant. Nothing magical, just somebody to swap conversation and arguments and complaints with, pulling the words out of each other like snake-poisoned blood. A person needs company. And it's not often you find a pal like the one I had. Old Shining Armor, the son of a bitch. Called him Shiny, or the Shine. He's a rare one. Tight-lipped and loyal. Sun Tzu said, "Don't ever hang out with degenerates. They'll pull you down." And he was right. But it cuts both ways. You end up with somebody like the Shine around you. Somebody with no guile and no bullshit. Only the truth, and a simple truth at that. And you can't help but return the favor and be a little better than you are. That's assuming you're any kind of decent human being anyway, which most of us aren't. Maybe especially not me. But I never let him down, you know? Never smoked, and I never let the Shine down. Not even when fists were flying and my boss, Fat Dave, that fucking tomato, was frothing at the mouth, crashing his post office duty van over the sidewalk, under the Fremont Bridge, with the bums and urchins scattering like crows around a highway carcass. I stuck with my old pal through all of it, let me tell you. Joe gets a job. Me and Shine met on the job. Co-workers, if you want to call it that. We were assigned together. Or I guess I was assigned to him, to look after him, you see. The Shine is simple, and that's the beautiful thing about him. But he's also easily confused, blind half the time, too dumb to ask questions, and lost more often than not. Shining Armor has good instincts, but he needs a caretaker. So, that's me. I'm out on a rainy afternoon with a six-pack of Tallboy Rainiers under my arm, a spring in my step, the goods wrapped in a brown paper bag like a Christmas present. Walking past the post office, I see this fella wearing a fuzzy red sweater, like it had been knit straight around him, tighter than a sausage casing. He's a real little guy, but fat, panting even. A beard clinging to his face like a chin strap while he struggles to staple a flyer to a telephone pole. Slowing, I can't tell what has him so heated up. It's sort of raining, just spinning, really, and the afternoon is bruised and brooding. My favorite kind of day. So I go ahead and ask the red balloon what about it. And the guy invites me right in for an interview. Says he's hiring for the easiest job in the world. Any sucker can do it. That sounds like me. So I follow him into the main post office, across those squeaky, polished floors from a 1950s high school, and into a cramped office, lit up under a fluorescent tube like the devil's nightlight. "You really want to hire me?" I ask him. "We're hiring anybody who'll take the job," he says. "Delivering mail?" "Yeah," he says, with an evil smirk. "Delivering the mail." I'm sort of intrigued. Perched on the edge of my chair, I wind up and take a breath and get all ready to explain away the DUIs and the rest of the record, to try to laugh them off, which never works, but I have to at least try. But the furry mound says this doesn't involve driving, just a whole lot of walking. And I sure as hell get excited then, because I think that's terrific. I'm a born walker. My whole family has long shanks, and I don't care about the weather either. Living in Portland, you've got to be waterproof. All kinds of proof, pretty much. He shoves over an employment contract stuck to a clipboard. But now, I'm picking up on how the guy is acting kind of snide. He's laughing at the light in my eyes, trying to sound convincing, but laughing at me, really. And I start to get it that he thinks I'm dumb. Which is fine. Why should I care what he thinks of my intelligence or lack of it? This guy, Dave, I see now because he's wearing a name tag on his sweater, he's no captain of industry. But the thing that worries me is how he seems to have this in-joke, like I was signing up for the army and a war just broke out. I sign anyway. Fuck it. Nobody much is offering me jobs. "How old are you, Chief?" he asks. "Old enough, Dave," I say. And he shakes his head. "You look older than that," he says. "Ah, well, fuck 'em." I shrug and pick up my sack of beers. "Good luck with your flyers," I say, showing him my back. He laughs once, kind of in disbelief. But before I can book it out of there, I hear his desk drawer grate open. There's this thunk and a rattle as I walk out the door. "Here, you're gonna need this," he says. Oh boy, I just gotta turn around to see. So I drop the prima donna act. And there on his desk, I swear to God, is a leash. "That's in your hand 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, until you quit or get fired," he says. Now old Dave has got my gears turning. I'm not thinking about those cold tall ones for the first time in a long time. I'm keen now, looking to find out what's got the crimson spud so hot and sweaty. I pick up the leash and turn it over in my rough hands. It's a silver coil, real futuristic. Some kind of attachment at the end with little pins in it, like the cables people sometimes use to charge their lumps of black glass at the bar. "So what the hell is this for?" I ask. "Not what," says Dave, smirking again, his double chin eating that chin-strap beard like a free buffet. "It's who?" I can already tell Dave's going to be a dick of a boss. And right then, I almost toss the leash down and go. I am actually starting to crave one of those beers sweating in the paper sack. And plus, I know I don't have the patience to make sure this ends well. So I give him one more second. And that's enough. "Come on," says Dave, standing up. I follow the chicken nugget down a cramped hallway into a beat-up little storage room. There's cardboard shreds strewn everywhere, dotted with packing peanuts like croutons, as if somebody unpacked something with some anger. And that's how I meet the shine. Isn't that terrific? He's standing there in the middle of the room, wavering a bit on his sturdy steel legs, a little slope-shouldered fellow with a face like a transistor radio. He stands up to about my midsection on backward ostrich legs, and he smells like a warm battery, kind of humming to himself. "A friggin' robot?" I ask. "Bipedal mail delivery unit," reads Dave off a piece of paper, scowling as he brushes packing peanuts off its metal-plated dome. "USPS is testing them out, seeing if they can't find a new kind of postman." You seem thrilled. "You picking up on that?" he says, voice rising. "This piece of crap is going to take my job. As soon as it learns the city routes, and that's why I have to hire somebody like you to lead him around by the nose until he can map the neighborhood. It could take 6 months. It could take a year. But the writing is on the wall." Somebody like me, huh? Right then, I decide I love the little piece of crap. Kneeling down, I let my fingers skim over the robot's plastic face. The metal casing over his shoulders and thighs is gleaming silver and warm. He has short little arms with flat hands like mittens. A blunt peg is sticking out of his back, for hanging a mailbag on, I figure. His eyes are round and glossy black. He blinks at me, slow, with a little click. I think he's handsome, like an old hound dog, but a lot shinier. "Like a little knight in shining armor," I say. But Dave doesn't hear me. He's muttering to himself, sweating rivers under that ridiculous sweater. And right then, I get the queer feeling this little fella standing here is the harbinger of big things to come. Joe and the Shine become good friends and inseparable. So here's the deal with the Shine. He doesn't judge, doesn't interrupt, and he goes with me everywhere. When he walks, it makes this nice wheezing sound. His narrow little feet are coated in a layer of tacky rubber, and each step lands quiet and smooth. And he always keeps up. The two of us walk together, a lot, and we make quite a goddamn sight. Everybody is on about the drones to deliver everything. And hell, maybe they're okay for the suburbs and the country. But in the city, there's no spot for those things to land, with all the trees and power lines and buildings. It's a hoof-it-or-bust proposition when you're downtown. Technically, Shine is a postman, but he doesn't carry any mail. Not yet. Dave says he's being trained, and the most important thing for him is to memorize every route at all different times, in all different weather, and with all the different changes of scenery that come along across the year. Plus, the eggheads are looking for what they call outliers, all the crazy shit that wasn't likely to happen, and yet it did. That's pretty much my specialty. I take the Shine with me everywhere, and we observe. I show him the patterns that I love, the flow of the shopkeepers, the tourists, and bums, the way the leaves form waving shadows on the sidewalks, and how the new LED street lamps shatter their light into grids of glowing squares. Even the traffic. He soaks it up, and I flatter myself that he appreciates it. "I can hear what you're thinking, all right? And look, I get that he's a machine. Not even that smart of one, except he's pretty good at walking. But I don't care. I'm not a judgmental type of guy. If the itch is scratched, I'm happy." And striding through the city with the Shine on my heels, his leash tucked through one of my belt loops, well, it makes me happy. It's just satisfying to have somebody by your side. So maybe you think there's something sad about that. But there isn't. And besides, you're free to screw off any time. Nobody's keeping you here. Lucky for me, Dave doesn't care when the miles get logged, so long as they do. Meaning I'm free to keep to my regular schedule of walking in the mornings and day drinking. And even better, a couple weeks in, I discover a compartment over the Shine's hip, like a glove box. It's just big enough for a flask of Jameson. From there, you can predict how things went with me and the Shine. We spent a lot of time together at the Goose. People stop and gawk every now and then. Sometimes they take pictures of him, like he's a real pretty dog. At some point, some kids slap their skateboard stickers on him while I'm taking a leak or grabbing another round. And he falls once or twice, collecting some scrapes and scars like the rest of us. The Goose regulars each have their own reaction, or non-reaction. Old Hemingway shuffles out the wooden front door of the Goose with his curled-up newspaper pages and his hearing aids. He looks at the robot, looks at me, and shakes his head. Keeps going right past and on to tend to his piggies. Sherry, Her Majesty, the Queen of the Goose, is the one who doesn't care for the Shine. She roosts next to her husband in the soaking grotto at the end of the bar, joking and bullshitting with her crowd, Adrian the busker, old Hemingway, Mallory, who's there as a captive audience, and whatever ragtag reprobates have straggled in. Sherry sits in front of a tall glass of grapefruit and vodka. Mostly vodka, honestly. She's got a figure like an hourglass, with football pads on. That may not sound good, but it's all right. She's also got this nice cackle that kind of punctuates the babble of drunken talking that goes on in there. The windows are always open, so I hear what they say, even though it usually washes over me as pure sound without meaning, which it mostly is anyway. But from my spot to her spot, it's only about 10 feet. The way I figure it, our getting together was pretty much inevitable. Proximity, you know? So it's too bad Sherry doesn't take to the Shine. Not at all. She likes to keep all the attention to herself, as it turns out. And if she had her way, she'd knock him to hell with a wrench. From my point of view, the Shine can't help attracting some notice. But she doesn't see it that way. Stealing her spotlight, you see? So she takes to scowling at us through the window, which is okay by me, I guess. There are a lot of cackling fish in the sea, so to speak, and even some without husbands. Joe and the Shine witness a crime. The day everything goes to shit starts like any other. I roll out of bed at the crack of dawn and hump it over to the post office back lot. Usually I'll sneak a quick beer from the mini fridge in my apartment, or if it's cold out, a flask of some liquid fire to warm me up. But today is going to be a nice summer day, the sky still pink, so I'm content with smelling the chlorophyll and enjoying the gentle sounds of the city waking up. Hoofing it all the time, you learn the ins and outs of where to go, depending on what you're looking for. If you're in the mood to see young people with different colors of hair and a little baby fat still clinging to their cheeks, riding bikes without the blessing of gears and going through the motions of being adults, why, walk past the art school. You want to see the new moms and their puppies and babies and round rear ends wrapped in the most advanced materials known to man? Well, that's the Pearl. And if you're in the mood to see the truth, or hell, just to see somebody who isn't doing as well as you, even if you're headed back to a creaking old empty apartment where the dish bowl for a cat who died 3 years ago is still lying out, well, those somebodies live in a stripe of shadow under the Fremont Bridge. What kills me is how young they are. You'd think the folks who've struck out would be older, the haggard types. But no, those ones have got it figured out by now. Those old slobs are all at the Goose, or doing a route between Mike's cellar and yours and the blackjack, letting themselves down slow. One step at a time. People can get good at anything, you know? Even losing. No, the ones I find under the bridge are mostly kids. Urchins, really, who still think they have something to prove. The weight of that bridge hasn't crushed their souls down into fine powder yet. They're still in the middle of it, and it's a rocky time. I don't want that way much. The post office parking lot is abandoned this early. A sprawl of blue-black asphalt and dirty warehouses and rickety old mail trucks. The place is a throwback to when this neighborhood was an industrial wasteland. Then it got trendy. And then less trendy. But it's always been where the big postal trucks root around like groaning dinosaurs, all chain link and exhaust and dark puddles, reflecting gray skies. The Shine has his own room behind a metal roll-top gate. Dave gave me the key, if you can believe that. It was even kind of touching. The first key an employer ever trusted me with. I'm starting to think the gray hair I'm sprouting is giving me some kind of a gravitas. I never earned it or wanted it, but I'll take it. Anyway, I yank up that gate, and there's the Shine, all plugged in and ready to go. "How about a little nip?" I ask him. I pat him down and take a pull off the flask that I keep in his hip pocket. Then I toss it back inside and slam his compartment shut. Snap the leash onto his shoulder and drop it through my belt loop, and we set off legging it down the street. "What do you want to do today?" I ask. He gives me that blank puppy dog look. "You read my mind, Shine," I wink at him. We do a long, silent loop through the hillside neighborhoods before I finally slide into my usual spot outside the Goose, feeling the sun pushing fingers through the tree that leans out here with me. Up and down the sidewalk, tourists are coming out in full force. I can't remember when they started showing up exactly, but here they are, filtering through the neighborhood like ants over a picnic, snapping pictures of the place like they were at Disneyland, and I'm playing the role of a lamppost. God, but they love those pigs. The big metal sculptures are bolted to the ground, a few feet away from me. On summer days like this, people are jamming cash into the things hand over fist. Pretty good haul for old Hemingway, and I'll bet he can do more than pay his bar tab with it. Between us, I think he really even donates some of that cash. The old man hobbles out right on schedule and tosses his papers down. Kneels and unlocks the box and empties out the bills and change. He's doing his thing just like clockwork. Problem is, when you've got money lying on the sidewalk for long enough, a certain type of person will notice. A kid is slouching toward us on a BMX bike that's been spray-painted black and scabbed over with duct-taped repairs. He's wearing a backward ball cap and a black bandana over his face, sort of like an outlaw. Whatever he's up to isn't great, but me and Hemingway move too slow to react. Kids like this are living life at twice our speed, flitting around like hummingbirds. Interesting to watch, scary even, but tiring. When you can't help but move slow, you learn to just relax and accept whatever the hell is going on. And this time around, what's going on is that Hemingway and his pigs are getting robbed. Another urchin comes around the smoking corner, also with a bandana on his face. And this one has a knife gleaming in his hand. He's waving his arms, young, shaking with adrenaline, eyes wide and scared over the bandana. "Give it," he says, as his friend pops the curb and rolls up behind. Old Hemingway just sighs. Slowly, he manages to stand back up. With one hand, he makes a dismissive gesture at the wad of bills spilling out of the box like stuffing from a torn couch. Greedy, the kids drop to their knees and start stuffing bills into the pockets of their hoodies. The Shine and I just sit and watch. Real heroes. Some faces are appearing in the Goose window. The shadowed, washed-out figures of drunks in a Greek chorus. They're relishing the excitement, buzzing with it, and I know I'll hear their feverish conversation about this for weeks. Deeper inside, Mallory has her piece of plastic up against her head, elbows thrust out, calling the police with barely any interest. And as the urchins stand up, I see Hemingway's eyes tighten. The old man leans into a tight right hook and catches a kid upside the head unaware. It knocks the kid's hoodie off, and he stumbles back in shock. "Ow!" he whines. Snatching his bandana off his face, the kid touches his eye tenderly, glaring at the old man where he stands, huffing and puffing. "Why'd you do that? Fuck!" The kid wheels around and looks right at me and the shine, a hurt expression on his face, the beginnings of a beard and mustache tracing dirty lines around his mouth and under his nose. I realize he's looking for sympathy. Christ, kids these days. "Come on," says his friend, grabbing his elbow. The urchin hops on the back of his friend's bike, holding his face with one hand and his friend's shoulder with the other. "You're a dick," he calls half-heartedly over his shoulder, as the getaway driver pedals furiously, headed toward the river and the bridge. Hemingway watches them go, breathing hard, fists clenched, a little smile hooked into the corner of his mouth. Joe sleeps with a married woman. Like I said, shit is going down all the time. Sometimes I watch it go down, and other times I'm more involved. Like with Sherry. She started out with careful looks and moved on to suggestive conversations. The close kind, where the other person is watching your lips the whole time. One day I asked her if she was trying to get me into trouble, and she said,
"A little bit."
That seemed like the right amount to me. Don't get me wrong, Sherry's husband is a nice guy. I don't feel for him exactly, but I don't not feel for him either, you know? He's older than me, always in fleece and tinted glasses and wearing half a grin, like maybe he doesn't understand quite what's going on, or maybe he just can't hear that great. He's the only one in the bar who actually watches the television. I've seen him sitting and watching, eyes shining, his back hunched like a kid on Saturday morning. "Jaws is on," he'll say to nobody. "Pretty woman, the Terminator." Sort of endearing, especially because he passes on watching sports, which I can respect. So, anyway, Mr. Nice Guy isn't a very observant type. He never perks to it when I give Sherry a little squeeze as I pass by, or vice versa. Of course, Mallory knew what was going on the day after I first let anything happen. So it's a good thing bartenders the world around know better than to talk about people's business. That's the only way they keep this whole thing from exploding. Sherry and Mr. Nice Guy have an apartment above the Goose. It's only a little place, but right in the middle of the neighborhood, which is good. It makes it a lot easier to sneak up every now and then, to grab a little more than a squeeze. So there I am, sitting outside with the shine, just shooting the shit with him, when I see her pale face peeking through the window. She glares at the shine, but then her eyes are on me, and those painted-on eyebrows are dancing up and down. Even a dope like me can figure out what's on her mind. Problem is, the shine doesn't do stairs very well, and he's real loud going up and down them. I'm not trying to draw attention to this whole tryst situation, especially with all the chattering crows perched on their bar stools. Sherry comes out and walks past, not even throwing a glance my way. She unlocks her front door and stomps up the wooden steps, leaving it cracked open behind her. "Shine, buddy," I say. "I've got to see a duchess about a new suit." The shine turns to me, kind of sad-looking with stickers all on him. But I gotta get up there while the getting is good. I stand and glance around. Up the block, I see Adrian perched on the corner with his guitar and his purple beret, The busker is a short guy with long, graying hair. Probably used to be handsome, but now he's nearly as old as I am. And worse, buried under the layers of coats and scarves and shit you've got to keep on you if you got no place to leave them. The guy can play that guitar, though. Enough to hit the goose at 4 o'clock and pay his tab when it closes every night. I doubt he's got a home, but the busker doesn't show it in how he stands or talks. Adrian, buddy, I'm calling, putting on a big shit-eating grin and pulling the shine along behind me toward the street corner. I seem to have already got this decision made, even though I'm not sure where exactly my thinking is coming from. Can you do me and my friend Jack Daniels a little favor? I ask. A little scowl flashes over his face at the interruption, but then I guess he gets it. The busker puts on a grin as wide and fake as mine. Anything for Jack, he says. Then Adrian holds the leash for me while I head upstairs. Joe and Sherry argue about the shine. Sherry's ready to go in her little apartment. But first she has to pick at me, like any woman does. And if you want to get into bed with her, then you shut up and take the ribbing, like any man does. But this time, she hits me on my weak spot. She hits me on the shine, telling me it's him or her. God damn it, Sherry, I'm explaining. The shine is no threat to anybody. He's dumb as a bag of hammers and twice as ugly. He's got nothing to do with you. I swear to God, what kind of an insecure person... He's a machine, Joe, she says. I'm a woman. I'm made of flesh and blood. And malice and jealousy. Shine's a damn sight more human than she'll ever be. Then think of me, why don't you? He means something to me. What? What's that robot to you, compared to me? He's my... friend? Nah, she'll jump on that like a nuke on a Pacific atoll. He's my job, you understand? Is that why you spend all afternoon drinking with him? Talking to him? Yeah, Sherry, I'm a workaholic, I say, bursting into laughter. I'm a goddamn workaholic, and you knew that about me from the start. And now she giggles too, in spite of herself, putting a hand over her mouth like a little girl. And whatever else there is about her, I've got to admit, she's wide at the top, thin in the middle, and damn wide at the bottom. I can tell she's half drunk already, and as usual, so am I. Come here, goddammit, I say, pulling on her. I take Sherry in my arms, fingers settling over the ridge where her bra strap cuts into her fleshy back. Pulling her close, she turns her head and rests her cheek on my shoulder, curly black hair tickling my chin. I feel her big, doughy breasts mashing against my chest in a way that makes my crotch tight. You're jealous of a robot, I say to her. Her hand steals down between us and settles in a good spot. I'll think about laying off the shine, she murmurs. But you gotta trade me something. Anything you want, darling, I murmur. The shine goes missing. Sherry hits the street first, and I wait in the cool stairwell a couple minutes, so we're not seen leaving together. Pretty much grade school level espionage, but we've got to at least pay lip service to this thing. Besides, it makes it more fun. Stepping out on the street, I'm feeling warm and cold. A little pang of regret, sure, but mostly just satisfaction at a job well done. Whistling, hands jammed in my pockets, I lean against the wall and wish I smoked. The afternoon rolls by for a few minutes, slow and golden. Bits of cottonwood fluff are floating down the hill from Forest Park. Cars are flickering like minnows through creek water. It's nice there for a minute, is what I'm trying to say. Then I get a bad feeling. The corner is empty. No Adrian. And no shine. Oh, God damn it, I mutter. I turn and beeline for the goose. The front door is propped wide open, and I round the corner hot.